This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This year marks our 30th anniversary as a daily NPR program, and this week we're featuring some of our favorite interviews from the early days. To start today's show, we have a 1988 interview with Elia Kazan. He directed Marlon Brando in A Streetcar Named Desire and On the Waterfront, and directed East of Eden, Splendor in the Grass, Baby Doll, A Face in the Crowd, and The Last Tycoon. Kazan had an equally important career in the theater. In the 1930s, he worked with the Group Theater, where he followed the vision of Lee Strasberg and learned the style of acting that became known as the Method. He later co-founded the Actor Studio with Strasberg. Many of Kazan's friends and colleagues never forgave him for naming names when he was called before the House Un-American Activities Committee in 1952, in the era when people accused of being communists lost their jobs. For many years, Kazan refused to publicly address the subject, but he broke the silence in his autobiography, Elia Kazan, A Life. I spoke with him when it was published. We started with this classic scene from A Streetcar Named Desire.
Hey, shut up!
You put that howling down there and go to bed.
Yes, I want my girls out here.
You shut up! You're going to get the law on
hey,
you.
Hey, Stella!
You and then call her back because she ain't going to come. You're going to have a baby.
Listen, you're...
I'll say haul you in and turn a fire
hose on
you.
I want my girls down here.
You stinker.
Hey, Stella! Hey, Stella!
I wouldn't mix in this.
Elia Kazan, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's start with A Streetcar Named Desire. Now, you actually really discovered Marlon Brando for the stage version of that, which you directed before directing the film. Why did you want him to audition for the role in the stage version?
Well, there was no audition. I had produced a play with Harold Klerman where he played a part, and he played a 5-6 minute scene, and he was stupendous and he was marvelous in it. And that was his audition. He didn't know it. But then when we lost John Garfield and I began to think who really would be good as Stanley Kowalski, I thought of Marlon and gave him $20 to go up and see Tennessee Williams up at the Cape. I learned later he hadn't showed up, but he'd hitchhiked and used the $20 to eat with. So, Williams took to him immediately. He called me up. He was ecstatic. He was overwhelmed, and that's all the audition there was.
When I think of all the actors and all the people in general who have imitated Brando doing Stella, untold numbers of people, what went on when you were directing him in that scene?
In that scene?
Yeah.
I just told him to get on his knees at the bottom of the staircase, but I didn't tell him what to do with his voice or how he should shout it. He just knew. Many things with him, many times with him, he was ahead of me. That is, he understood what I said and understood it better than I said it. And I hardly had to tell him anything. Once I said, you fall on your knees, and he did. And that's all there was to it.
How many takes did you do of that scene?
How many takes did I do? I think 2.
And you knew you had it?
Yeah. Well, you couldn't mistake it, could you, really? That tone of voice, I mean, people have imitated it and shouted it and it's been on comedy shows and everything. It's just once in a decade a voice like that comes out.
Now, you directed Brando again 3 years later in On the Waterfront. I found out in your book that it was initially supposed to be Frank Sinatra in the role.
Yeah, he would have been damn good, too, but not as good as Brando. I don't think anybody's as good as Brando, but Frank would have been very good. Frank comes from Hoboken, and he's a street kid, too, and he's tough. And he would have been good. And he's tough the way Brando's tough. He's got a tough exterior and knows what to do with his fists and so on. But he also has a very poetic and romantic side that comes out in his songs, of course. Anyway, I was ready to do it with Frank, but one thing led to another in the contracting, and also in Frank's schedule. He had to be somewhere at a certain time. I've forgotten the details of it, and we switched to Brando.
Brando in that movie really has this combination of strength and vulnerability.
Right, Terry, you hit it.
What did you talk with him about when he took on the role? About what characteristics you wanted him to get in there?
Just that. I said he's keeps a tough front towards everybody, but he feels his guilt about Eva Marie Saint's brother terribly, that it kills him. He can't get rid of it. And he really would like to be out of the gangster hoodlum world and didn't like what they did to him because they humiliated him. The part Lee Cobb played constantly humiliated him, made him appear like a cheap kid. And I told him that he would resent that and not show it for a while and then release it as the film went on.
I want to play another one of the most famous scenes in movie history. And this is the I Could Have Been a Contender scene. Now, in your book, you're very self-effacing about it. You say that you've been highly praised for the direction of the scene, but the truth is you didn't really direct it. It kind of directed itself. I don't truly believe that, so let's hear the scene, and then we'll talk about it.
I'll say one thing about it before you do.
Okay.
The scene is good for several reasons, but one reason is because it was beautifully written by Bud Schulberg. It's a perfectly written scene, and in a kind of a tough language that is poetic in itself, that's all.
And the scene is played by Marlon Brando and Rod Steiger.
Right.
That skunk we got you for the manager, he brought you along too fast.
It wasn't him, Charlie, it was you. You remember that night in the garden, you came down my dressing room and said, kid, this ain't your night. We're going for the price on Wilson. You remember that? This ain't your night. My night, I could have taken Wilson apart. So what happens? He gets the title shot outdoors in a ballpark, and what do I get? A one-way ticket to Palookaville. You was my brother, Charlie. You should have looked out for me a little bit. You should have taken care of me just a little bit so I wouldn't have to take them dives for the short-end money.
Oh, I had some bets down for you. You saw some money.
You don't understand. I could have had class. I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody instead of a bum, which is what I am. Let's face it. It was you, Charlie.
There's a musicality in the way those two actors read their lines that is really something. Did you work with them on that?
No. I didn't direct that scene much. I didn't direct that scene, really. By that time in the shooting schedule, both Rod and Marlon knew what they had. And then the lines themselves are so beautifully written. Instead of a bum, which is what I am, that's the way those people talk. They're perfectly written lines, and Marlon naturally took to them.
You have really taken pride in directing actors who are encouraged to ask questions about what they're doing.
Yes.
What kind of questions did Brando ask you about this role? Any questions?
Very, very little. I think we had an instinctive fraternity. I think we understood each other almost from the word go very well. And we would talk a lot about other things, but not a hell of a lot about the role. This role is written thoroughly. When he says taking dives, Palookaville, all that, and it's written very thoroughly and beautifully. And he didn't need much instruction. I mean, I wasn't kidding in the book. I wasn't being falsely modest. I think I'm a damn good director and have been a damn good director. But in this scene, I didn't direct that scene much. Very little. I just put them there and so on.
A lot of the extras in On the Waterfront were actually longshoremen.
Right, and hoodlums.
And hoodlums, yeah. So you had a bodyguard in the making of the movie?
I had a bodyguard 6 feet behind me at all times. Well, there were some rough characters all around me, and they were taking offense that we showed... We showed Hoboken, for example, for a bad place, and they were offended. I laugh at that. But anyway, they had civic pride. That's what made me laugh. I thought they had civic pride, and nobody threatened me much. Once a fella came and slammed me against the wall and was going to beat me up, but then the bodyguard and another friend named Brownie came up, and that was the end of that threat.
Gosh. Let's move on to another movie you directed. Now, we talked about how you really basically discovered Marlon Brando. You also really discovered James Dean. You gave him his first film role in your film East of Eden.
Yeah.
I find that kind of interesting in a way because they were both at the time young actors with this pent-up energy and alienation.
Yeah, that's it. Alienation is right. Pent-up energy is right. Terry, you've got it exactly right. Not especially. Both of them, the same way. Same thing in both of them. Somehow that must have appealed to me because maybe I have pent-up energy and alienation, too. I feel brotherly towards them.
Would you describe the meeting with James Dean that made you realize he had something?
I went to see a play of his, and a friend of mine named Paul Osborne had recommended him to me. And I went to see him in a play. He played a part of an Arab, a small part, and I didn't think much of him. But I thought, just to please Paul, I'd ask him to come into Warner Brothers office. And I went in there that day, and there he was, like a, I say in the book, like a pile of rags in a corner, all bent over, scrunched up, and so on. I thought, well, he didn't even get up, didn't look at me, he didn't get up. And so I went in the office and I thought, well, I'll make the son of a bitch wait a little bit, it'll do him good. So anyway, finally I called him into the office and he came in and he didn't say anything. He was not a talker. So finally he didn't say a damn thing. And I said, well, and he said, do you want to go for a ride with me on my motorbike? So I said, God, I hate motorbikes. I didn't say it to him, but I do hate motorbikes. I think they're a menace. And I said, all right, Jimmy, well, let's go. So I went downstairs and he got his motorbike and unlatched it or unchained it or whatever he did, and I got in the back, and he rode me around the middle of the city, and it was like he was showing that a country boy can defy the city and defy the rules of the city. He zigzagged in and out. I didn't want to ruin my relationship as a director by saying, Jimmy, I'm frightened, cut it out. I was frightened, but anyway, we finally both lived.
I want to play a scene from this movie, and this is a scene where, well, for our listeners who haven't seen the movie in a long time, in East of Eden, there's a father played by Raymond Massey, and he has two sons. One son he favors, the son he doesn't favor is James Dean. And James Dean has worked really hard to endear himself to his father. He's invested money in bean futures in the hopes of making back money that his father lost. And it's his father's birthday. He's presenting him the money, but his father won't accept it. Here's that scene with Raymond Massey and James Dean.
As for you, it's all the money you lost in the lettuce business. That's for you, and I made it for you.
Cal, you will have to give it back.
No, I made it for you, Dad. I want you to have it.
You'll have to give it back.
Who? I can't give it.
To the people you got it from.
No, British Purchasing Agency? I can't give it back to them.
Then give it to the farmers you robbed.
We didn't rob anybody. That we paid 2 cents a pound, 2 cents over the market for that stuff.
Cal, I sign my name, and boys go out, and some die, and some live helpless without arms and legs. Not one will come back untorn. Do you think I could take a profit from that? I don't want the money, Cal. I couldn't take it. I thank you for the thought, but
I'll keep it for you. I'll wrap it up, and we'll just keep it in here.
I'll never take it.
There's a great part right after that where you can't tell whether James Dean is going to hug or slug his father.
That is good, yeah.
Now, you write in your book that there really was a tension between James Dean and Raymond Massey. And
yes,
you basically tried to exploit that in the movie.
They didn't like each other. And especially Ray Massey couldn't stand Dean. He just hated to play scenes with him. And I guess I did exploit it because I didn't do anything about curing it or easing it. And you see how much he resents him in the scene, in the role, but also he did in life. It served my purposes to not do anything about it. I didn't egg them on to each other, but I didn't do anything to keel it.
You know, in the clips that we just heard, we heard from Brando and from Dean, two very different actors in that Brando you describe as an actor with a lot of technique, Dean as an actor who had virtually none, at least at the time you directed him. How does that change you as a director, depending on whether you're working with someone who has a lot of technique or someone who's more of a natural and doesn't have that technique?
You adapt to what each one is. I talked more to Jimmy than I ever did to Marlon. I took him aside, and finally, when I felt he was disturbed in life by what was happening in his own personal life, I moved him into a dressing room on the Warner Brother lot, and I took the dressing room directly facing it so that I'd always be at hand. I was like a father to him or a big brother to him, and looked after him. Every morning I'd call him out and see what condition he was in, whether he had a miserable night or not. And then I had to several times stop him from owning a horse or a motorbike or whatever, you know. So it became a very different, more intense, more particular relationship. With Marlon, I didn't have to do anything like that.
We're listening back to my 1988 interview with director Ilya Kazan. We'll hear more after a break as our 30th anniversary retrospective continues. This is Fresh Air. We're continuing our 30th anniversary retrospective, featuring interviews from our first 2 years. Let's get back to my interview with director Ilya Kazan, which was recorded in 1988 when he published his autobiography. Now, your autobiography is really the first time you've publicly addressed why you named names during the HUAC hearings in the 1950s. And I was wondering why you were ready to talk about it now. For years when you were interviewed, people would ask you about it, and you just wouldn't want to talk about it. People have written in their autobiographies how they felt about you naming names, but you've never publicly addressed it till now.
The reason I felt okay about it now was that I always hesitated to do it because I wanted to make it part of my whole life.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, so that everything that happened before had some way or other, not for others, but for me, led up to it. And for example, I put in the scene where the man from Detroit came and attacked me in front of my group. I put in the scene where we were trying to do a picture in Mexico and the communists there prevented us from doing it for their reasons. I put in other references so that by the time I got to it, you felt I'd been through certain experiences that would at least motivate me, if no one else, into doing that.
Well, my understanding is that you decided to talk for two reasons. One was that you felt that when you were a member of a communist group that the actors are really exploited by the party, and also that you didn't want to give up your career, that you'd really thought about it, and you decided that writers could write while they're in prison, but directors couldn't do anything in prison, and directors couldn't do anything if they were shut out of the industry.
Something like that, but not exactly. I thought, you know, I love my work, and it means everything to me. It's my whole life, really, except my family and my work. Those are the two things I have, and I thought, why should I give up my my career for something I don't believe in? I don't believe in it. And if people who are communists are still are going to attack me and still feel that they don't want to talk about it, I also feel that then the hell with them. I also feel that any country, for example, England and France, any country has the right to investigate something like was going on in this country. And the only trouble with our committee was that two of the fellows lied to me. They told me that I was in an executive session where I'd be talking privately, and it turned out they were running with the news to Hollywood gossip columnists and everything else, so I lost my respect for them, too.
There are many people who have been in your life who've never forgiven you for naming names and have certainly never forgotten it. Did you expect this decision to stay with you throughout your life in the way that it has?
No, you have to believe me, Terry, I don't give a darn about that.
Uh-huh.
I only am concerned, really, whether I respect myself. I thought a very long time about it. I thought very hard about it, and I did I made a difficult choice. Both sides, both ways would have been difficult for me.
Have you had second thoughts about the choice you made?
Not really, no. I wish they'd done it. I wish they'd named me. I think if the whole bunch of us had come out and said, we did have a communist cell, so what? I don't think they would have been worse off. I think it would have been clear the air. But, of course, except for the three I did talk to, they didn't do it.
Director Ilya Kazan recorded in 1988. He died in 2003 at the age of 94. In 1988, I also spoke with actor Kirk Douglas, who helped break the Hollywood blacklist when he produced the 1960 film Spartacus, which he also starred in. Douglas decided to hire a blacklisted writer, Dalton Trumbo, to write the screenplay for Spartacus. Dalton Trumbo was writing it under a pseudonym, like he was writing all of his screenplays at the time, because he was blacklisted, and you insisted that for this movie he actually use his real name. Did you think that the time was right where you could say, this is Dalton Trumbo who wrote the movie, and where it would actually be accepted, that the time was right to break the blacklisting and have it be accepted, at least in part of Hollywood?
Well, I'm not so sure. I did it rather impulsively. I don't think I was aware until a couple years later, as I reflected upon it, and as I explain in my book, I began to see, you know, the significance of it. What bothered me when I did Spartacus was the hypocrisy in Hollywood, that these people, some of them who spent a year in jail for a crime that was never very clearly stated, were denied denied using their talents except behind the scenes. Studio heads would look the other way while a lot of these unfriendly 10 writers would be writing scripts for very little money. So it was so hypocritical that it annoyed me to the extent that I said, well, what happens? we had a discussion of whose name are we going to put on the script of on the screen of Spartacus. And suddenly I said, well, what happens if I put Dalton Trumbo's name on? And they said, oh, Kirk, you're bound. He said, you know, you're going to get out of the business and all that. I said, no, the hell with it. I'm going to do it. And the next day I left the pass. Dalton Trumbo hadn't been on a set in 10 years. I left the pass for Dalton Trumbo. No Sam Jackson. Of course, even Sam Jackson, we wouldn't have allowed on the set. Somebody might have recognized him as Dalton Trumbo.
That was his pen name for this movie.
Yes, and from then on, I mean, I'll never forget when Dalton Trumbo walked on the set, came over to me and says, Kirk, thanks for giving me back my name. There were people who, I got letters from different organizations, had a Hopper attack me, but the sky didn't fall in. And after that, a few months after that, Otto Preminger announced that Dalton Trumbo was going to be writing this script, and the blacklist was broken.
We'll hear more of my interview with Kirk Douglas, and we'll hear my 1988 interview with director Sidney Lumet in the second half of the show as we continue the Fresh Air 30th Anniversary Retrospective. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.